12 weeks for £12. Subscribe to The Spectator for this excellent deal and get a £20 Amazon voucher at www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Alex Massey, our Scotland editor, and Kate Andrews, our economics correspondent. So today, the Scottish Education Secretary, John Swinney, gave a statement to Holyrood in which he announced a pretty dramatic U-turn on the exam results from last week. Here's what he had to say.
I can confirm to Parliament today that all downgraded awards will be withdrawn. Using powers available to me in the Education Scotland Act 1996, I am today directing the SQA to reissue those awards based solely on teacher or lecturer judgment.
Now, this means that all the grades that were downgraded will be reversed to what teachers had been predicting, but all the grades that have been upgraded will remain the same. That impacts about 76,000 Scottish pupils. Now, Alex, was this a predictable U-turn despite a week of feet dragging?
Well, I mean, I think the scale of this climb down is the first thing to note and so on. It is one of the most dramatic and swift reverses that the SNP has suffered since the party came to power in Edinburgh in 2007, you know, 13 years. And this, you know, in ordinary circumstances would be a monumental humiliation for the Scottish government. No matter how you dress it up and so on, you know, on Friday, Nicola Sturgeon and John Swinney were defending the way in which the exam results were moderated. The computer algorithm that downgraded a lot of teacher estimates based in part on the history of schools' prior performance. So if you came from a poor school, but one that might be improving, you were likely to see your grades downgraded. And they defended this on the grounds that just simply accepting teacher estimates, teacher predictions, would lead to an incredible increase in the pass rate, the stripping the qualifications of whatever credibility they ordinarily have. Today, the Education Secretary and the First Minister accept that, well, if we have to put up with incredible results, that is, so be it, you know. That is better than the unfairness meted out to pupils who, as they put it and so on, have ended up failing exams they didn't even sit. And so you have this huge change of course. And it's probably the simplest way of doing it, to be honest. If you could see that the first time around they got it wrong, then all you're really left with is just accepting the teacher predictions and the teacher estimates. And so that is what they have done. Although, of course, in a thing where everybody must have prizes, those pupils whose predicted exam results were upgraded will keep those upgraded results. But everybody whose results were downgraded will instead revert to what their teachers had predicted.
So it does mean that the universities in Scotland will have much higher intake than usual. Is that right, Alex?
Yes, but the Scottish Government has announced that they will make additional provision for universities to ensure that they have the capacity to accept all the people who have now gained the grades required to attend a university course of their choice. But they're claiming that nobody will lose out in terms of university or college places.
Now, Kate, one other person watching that statement, as well as, you know, tens of thousands of Scottish pupils, is Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary for the UK, because this Thursday coming is the A-level results for students in England and Wales. Now, for students in England, I think it's a similar sort of calculation. So are we going to see a similar thing? What is Gavin Williamson going to do?
This does put the Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, in a trickier position, as England were expected to use the same kind of formula that has gotten Scotland into this mess. Also, kids aren't going to be able to challenge their grades, only the schools are going to be able to do so on their behalf, which means a lot of kids will be in a position where they feel that the grades that they've been dished out are deeply unfair and in no position to do anything about it. There's an obvious trade-off here. Either kids get the benefit of the doubt and they potentially even get an undeserved good grade, or some kids will be getting an undeserved bad grade. You can argue that both situations are not ideal, but it strikes me that this U-turn in Scotland is moving in a positive direction, because it is better to give these kids an opportunity, even if it's not fully deserved, than to undermine the children that have worked so hard and would only be penalised because they went to a school that hasn't performed as well in the past and isn't considered very good. There are major implications for social mobility, and I think that the exact same questions that we're asking Scotland this week are going to be asked of the Education Secretary this week, especially when you have an outburst of kids who feel that on their own merit they would have done better and have no way of proving it. The last thing I would say, though, is that Nicola Sturgeon saying that provisions will be made for universities in Scotland to cater to more placements could prove very expensive. And I have no doubt that the Prime Minister, perhaps when he's back from his holiday in Scotland, and the rest of the Cabinet will remind her of this, because it has become a big talking point that Scotland could not have been as generous with its COVID proposals and policies. It very likely couldn't do this if it didn't have the backing of the Bank of England directly financing the Treasury and making all of this spending possible. So it does sound like a very expensive commitment, and one that actually Number 10 may try to use to its advantage.
Alex, what are the implications of this pretty delayed U-turn? I mean, it's been a week of feet dragging on firstly the SNP, but also on the union, which you're going to be writing about for our upcoming cover piece.
Well, you know, ordinarily you would expect that this kind of fiasco and shambles, because that is what it has been, would lead to a ministerial resignation. And there is a vote of no confidence tabled by the Labour Party in John Swinney that will be debated at Holyrood on Thursday. I suspect that he will survive that, because I think the various sort of inquiries into this episode, plus the decision to reverse the downgraded results, will be sufficient to satisfy the Green Party, and they will either abstain or vote with the SNP to support John Swinney and keep him in place. You know, but ordinarily, you know, this kind of shambles, you know, should have some kind of political accountability attached to it. But such is the SNP's dominance in Scottish politics. Remember, 50% of voters are likely to endorse SNP candidates at the next Holyrood election in May. Such is their dominance that, you know, many of the ordinary rules of political accountability, frankly, don't really apply in Scotland. And although, again, something of this sort ought, you would think, to have a political impact, I suspect that in the end it will not, partly because, generally speaking, only about one in six voters truly thinks that education is ever one of the top issues in terms of the political agenda. And a lot of the time, you know, if you have children of school age and they are at a good school and you're happy with their education, you're not actually necessarily all that concerned as a general rule by the disadvantages suffered by other people's children. And so it's not actually quite as dominant a political issue as you might think, given the importance attached to it. And Nicola Sturgeon says that education is her number one priority, etc., etc., etc. And so I would actually be surprised if this has a significant impact on the SNP's fortunes next May. It is quite apparent that the SNP is going to be the largest party at Holyrood again, and it will be another SNP First Minister as the party goes into a fourth term. The question is whether they have an overall majority, and that is perhaps a 50-50 proposition at present. So I would not actually expect it to change too much, partly because the SNP's dominance is such that they can afford to lose 10% of their voters and still be the dominant party in Scotland.
Bloody hell. And Kate, meanwhile, new figures from the Office for National Statistics show the new unemployment figures, and that they've fallen for the largest decrease in 10 years, 730,000 fewer employees on the payroll. Can you crunch the numbers for us?
Well, two interesting headlines from today. The first is that, as you said, Cindy, we've seen the biggest decrease in UK employment for a decade since the financial crash. But at the same time, the unemployment rate in the UK didn't budge. It's still at 3.9%, which is one of the lowest on record. So how are both of these things possible? And what the ONS data shows us today, looking at the latest quarter, is that you have more economic inactivity, which means that people may be out of work, but they're not actively looking for jobs. And that's reflected by the fact that job vacancies are also on the ground. You just have fewer people offering jobs, fewer employers recruiting employees, obviously not wanting to take on that financial risk at this time. So even though the headline statistic about unemployment rates hasn't moved, in all that that underlying data reported from the ONS today, you can see that economic reality is really starting to catch up with the labor market. I think a big one to look at is the claimant count that the ONS has published. That's the number of people eligible for some kind of unemployment benefit. Between March and now, that has skyrocketed by 117%, which is roughly 1.4 million that are now dependent on some kind of unemployment benefit. You have 7.5 million people temporarily away from paid work in the month of June alone. Over 3 million of those people have been away from work for 3 or more months. That speaks to the furlough scheme. In many ways, you could interpret today's data as showing how successful the furlough scheme has been. It has kept a lot of people, in theory at least, employed. The question is, now that it's being rolled down this month, August is the first where employers have to contribute 5% of their employees' cost, September 10%, October 20%, and then it ends. As that happens, are employers in the financial position to keep all of their employees on? I suspect the furlough scheme will have saved many jobs, but we know that potentially millions are jobs in name only at the moment. People are on furlough and they're probably not coming back. I mean, we still have sectors and certain kinds of businesses that have not opened yet. And so many sectors, especially in hospitality, food and drink, are not able to operate at full capacity. So we know that bad news is coming. We know that those headline statistics on employment and unemployment are going to change. They're going to move, and unemployment is expected to rise in a quite hefty way come the end of the year in 2021. The question is, to what extent did the furlough scheme save some of those jobs? And will there be jobs for people to come into as hopefully the economy improves, as people who are newly made redundant potentially go into new lines of work? That is a massive question mark around this so-called V-shaped recovery, whether or not we're going to get one, and really whether or not the economy can stay even semi-open, as there's already talk of local lockdowns.
And Kate, is this all within the Treasury's calculations that we'd be seeing figures like this before the furlough scheme even was rolled back? And does this change Rishi Sunak's decision to end it at the end of October?
There have been estimations within the Treasury around unemployment, of course. I think they're closely following that. The Bank of England, the Office of Budget Responsibility, all of the big hitters are trying to follow and forecast a scenario for unemployment. And whilst a lot of the scenarios so far have shown a pretty good and fairly fast recovery, although that has dampened in the past few months, they all suggest that it's going to take a lot longer for jobs to bounce back, which is very concerning. But we know that the Treasury doesn't want to pick winners and losers in the job sector, especially for retaining jobs. We don't know what they'll do if there are serious lockdowns that could last for months at a time. There could be a case that if you're going to keep a particular sector locked down for a longer period of time, that maybe you support it. But then the question is, are these jobs really viable? If they haven't opened for 6 months, a year, year and a half, are they really still even there? And I don't think that a government that has any sense of market initiatives, and the Treasury certainly does, would want to interfere so much that it kept jobs theoretically alive that don't have a place in this economy anymore.
And Alex, finally, the furlough scheme is one of the things that the Westminster government is using in this campaign to keep the union together. And we saw Chancellor Rishi Sunak talk about that when he visited Scotland last week as well. When the furlough scheme ends, and that, let's say there is mass unemployment, what would that mean for the SNP's campaign north of the border?
I think that, fairly or not, the UK government is going to find itself in a pretty difficult situation. You know, you are absolutely right, of course, that, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Scottish jobs, Scottish families are being supported by the furlough scheme, the self-employment scheme, various other government mechanisms, just, you know, in Scotland, just as is the case in every other part of the United Kingdom. But crucially, as a political matter, that has not really cut through with voters in Scotland. It is the kind of thing that is, if you like, taken for granted, the least that people would expect. And so there is very little political upside to it, no great reward for doing what is seen to be the right thing to do anyway. And so people are much more likely to give Nicola Sturgeon credit for her handling of coronavirus aspects that are within her remit than they are to give Boris Johnson and the UK government any credit whatsoever. Nicola Sturgeon's approval ratings are very, very positive. Boris Johnson's are very, very, very negative. And that also seems likely to remain the case for the foreseeable future. And it reflects a situation where good things in Scotland are credited to the Scottish government and bad things in Scotland are credited to the UK government. And if the UK government does something that is deemed to be good, the importance of that good thing is downplayed to the point where it ceases to have any real political benefit or upside at all. Again, this is unfair. Unionists can complain that the deck of cards is stacked against them, and perhaps it is, but that is unfortunately the way the game is being played in Scotland at present. And that provides a long-term challenge for the union, not just in terms of what it stands for, but what it delivers and is seen to deliver. And that is also a crucial point, because perception, as we all know in politics, often proves a more powerful force than reality. Scotland benefits financially from being part of the United Kingdom, and independence would be an expensive, difficult business, at least for the first decade. But at the moment, voters in Scotland appear to be privileging sovereignty over economics, and that is the sort of situation in which the SNP can be expected to thrive, and it poses a real challenge for unionism in terms of how it makes itself relevant and vital and fit for, not just the next year or two, but the next 20, 30, 50 years, and that is a real long-term challenge as well.
Alex and Kate, thanks very much. And to hear more from Alex Massey on Scotland and the Union, he writes about it in our upcoming cover piece, so do pick up an issue when that comes out later this week. And I'll also be speaking to him again about the Union on our weekly podcast, The Edition, which comes out on Thursday evenings. So tune into that as well. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.